This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What do you know about science, and how did you learn it? In school, from the internet, newspapers, John Stewart? If you're like most Americans and Europeans, television is your source of news, at least according to a recent study by the National Science Foundation that looked at the public's understanding of and attitudes towards science. And the same study also noted that most Americans don't feel well informed about science. Well, why is that not a surprise, huh? The numbers, 2/3 admit that they don't understand the scientific process. 60% say they believe in ESP, extrasensory perception. So just how does the public's misunderstanding of science filter down to everyday life? Might it account for the downturn in scientists that are graduating from American schools? And how our beliefs like issues ranging from global warming, genetically modified foods, radiation, evolution, how are these beliefs shaped by culture? For example, why were Europeans so dead set against GM foods for a long time while Americans were not? We'll talk about these topics. We'll dig into this subject this hour. We're broadcasting from the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science this week here in Washington. And we'd also like to welcome to our broadcast teachers and students from Oyster Bilingual Elementary School in Washington. Thank you, kids, for joining us. Hopefully, you'll step up to the microphone that we have here in the auditorium and ask your questions. We welcome all of you to do that. Also, if you're home, 1-800-989-8255 is our number, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Dr. Leon Lederman won the 1988 Nobel Prize in Physics. He is Director Emeritus of the Fermi National Accelerator Lab, Fermilab, and the founder of the Illinois Math and Science Academy. Good to see you again, Leon. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Melissa Pollack is a senior analyst at the National Science Foundation in Arlington, Virginia. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Nick Allam is a lecturer at the University of Surrey in the United Kingdom. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Allam.
Thank you.
Sharon Friedman is a professor of journalism and communication and director of the Science and Environmental Writing Program at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Welcome back to the program, Sharon.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about, Melissa, let's talk about the talk you gave this morning called Americans Love Science, But They Don't Know Much About It. How do you know they love it if they don't know much about it? What kinds of things do they love about it?
Well, we have some questions that ask about support for the federal government's funding of basic research, and year after year, our data show that the public agrees that the government should be funding scientific research, even if it has no immediate benefits. We also look at how enthusiastic Americans are when it comes to new communication technologies and other types of technologies, how quickly we have embraced the internet and cell phone ownership, for example, even DVD players. It seems like almost every home now has one of those. In looking at the responses to those types of questions, we see a lot of public enthusiasm for science, and there seems to be public recognition that science has improved their lives, has improved their health, their safety, and helped with economic prosperity as well.
But they don't know why. Some of the most basic, simple concepts. I'm looking at the survey you gave them. For example, you asked them a question: how long does it take the Earth to go around the sun? A year. And they didn't. A lot of people didn't know that. With only 58% or something.
That's right.
Knew that.
It's disturbing to.
They still think that the sun is going around the Earth, or they just don't know how that works.
Unfortunately, there wasn't a follow-up question to that. It's just...
Well, I'm reminded there was a very famous study done a while ago, you may remember, where they took the whole Harvard graduating class. Remember, Leon? And they asked them, why do we have seasons?
Hot in the summer, cold in the winter.
That's
why?
Right. Why? And why was it hot? And they said because the Earth was closer in the summertime. And what was it, class of 35 and only one person got it right?
Well, we know about Harvard, you know.
Does this surprise you, as an educator, that we know so little about these basic things about science?
It doesn't surprise me anymore because we've been living with this for some time. It's depressing. It's terribly depressing. It's alarming. It's dangerous, I think, for our future that so few people have a grasp of how science works, and even less of a grasp of the, what's involved.
Melissa, you said that most of the people are getting their news from television,
That's right.
Science news from television. Is it Nova or Jon Stewart that they're getting their science news from?
It's a little bit of everything. Unfortunately, it's not a lot of Nova. If you look at the number of people watching Nova as opposed to the number of people watching the broadcast networks, the numbers speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. You have Nova, which does excellent programming, and then you have shows on some of the broadcast networks that seem to promote the misunderstanding of science in a few cases. Mm-hmm. I'll give you one example. Upcoming is a show next week on UFOs. I'm a little bit wary about what they're gonna tell the public mm-hmm. about the existence of UFOs.
Mm-hmm. Nick Allam, you come from across the pond there. Look at stuff in Europe. Are the perceptions very much different? You did a study of that with a surprising result.
They're not that different. I think it's true to say in Europe that there's a little bit more skepticism in general about science and technology. People are a little bit more unwilling to be absolutely gung-ho about unalloyed benefits of science. But, I think we can perhaps sometimes overemphasize these differences. I mean, most people on both sides of the pond seem to be pretty happy, in many ways, with science and the role of science in promoting welfare and so forth.
I think we have the impression here that Europeans are much more science savvy and they're more knowledgeable about science. Is that not true?
Actually, it's not. It's precisely the reverse. I mean, there's not too much difference, but if you there's many surveys going back 10 or 15 years, and certainly for the last 5 or 6 years, and I think Melissa will probably be able to confirm this, that the Americans are slightly more knowledgeable about basic textbook scientific facts, if you like, at least. So it's
that's surprising. Leslie, you agree?
The differences aren't great. Just slightly more knowledge on the part of Americans.
Uh-huh. Sharon, the fact that they're getting their news from television, is that a bad thing?
It's disturbing because what the television can do for you, let's say on newscasts, is give you a headline and a few sentences. Therefore, you don't get any depth, you don't get any context, you don't get the facts that you really need as a reader to understand the science, particularly if you're dealing with a controversy such as genetically modified foods or nanotechnology or some of these other risk issues. That's a significant problem. You just don't get the depth there.
Mm-hmm. Did you find, Nick, also that the more educated people were, the more they knew about, would make sense, the more they knew about science?
That's certainly true, yes. I guess that would be kind of a common sense thing. But yeah, that's certainly true.
So why do we think there was such a wide gap? And I know it's narrowing in a topic about genetically modified foods, for example.
Sure.
It was just you couldn't even talk about it over in Europe, and or even banned on airplanes. I remember little notes saying on airplanes when I fly, there are no GM foods in any of the food on this airplane.
Yes, well, that's still the case. I mean, in restaurants you go into, it's sort of a selling point. You know, we can charge more because we don't have any GMOs in our food, even though how the restaurants could actually tell is somewhat difficult. It became a party political issue in Britain, as well as just a kind of a public issue. The two parties kind of started dividing, the Conservatives and the Labour Party. So once it became a political issue, then the public got even more fired up about it. But I think it owes a lot to the history. We had the BSE crisis, which you probably heard about. Mad cow disease.
Right.
And that, I think, had a fundamental effect on framing the way that potentially risky new technology comes into play now. People just think, well, they got it wrong before, why should we believe them this time?
And I watch this now, and it seems like when you talk about it being a political issue, and it's almost like the global warming issue is in this country now.
I think once it does become a political issue, what you found with the GM debate back in 1999 when it came on was that suddenly it was the political writers on the newspapers that were starting to take up the story. It came away from the science writers, and so it just became a big political rumpus, if you like, and the kind of science of it got left a little bit a bit behind.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was a big factor in it.
Leon, science and politics now are everywhere.
Everywhere. That's right. I mean, you know, traditionally, science can advise you on what's good and what isn't good. They can invent, devise, understand, explain. But ultimately, the applications of science, which we call technology, depends always on some political decision you have to make. It's not always, unfortunately, black and white. Scientists tend often to qualify their conclusions, even though they might satisfy 9 out of 10. They still say, yes, the probability is very high that global warming is produced by human activity, and give all sorts of data on that, which will stultify the average reader. But somebody has to make a decision, because there would be economic consequences to that, and we understand that. And so what you depend on is government, who are maybe fortunately not scientists, but making wise decisions based on the best information they have. That's what you hope. And that's what brings you to the intense desire that all citizens should have some basic understanding of how science works.
Should scientists, there have been called by some scientists for others, it's time for scientists to get political again. Is that a mistake?
I think it's not a mistake. I think it depends on how the scientist words his advice. But again, science has to call attention to things where they're worried about something, and global warming is a good example. Huge number of scientists are now very concerned about the melting glaciers. There's vast evidence that something is going wrong, hurricanes and so on. And if they say it in their official capacity, that's one thing. If nobody listens, then the scientists might have to feel that it has to bring this to the attention of the public. That's called being political, if you like. But I think that becomes essential. Or else, how will they know?
All right, we're going to take a break and come back, talk lots more about how we know what we know and what we believe in science and how it affects public policy. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about science and public policy, how culture shapes science and science shapes culture, with our guest, Leon Lederman, Director Emeritus of the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory and founder of the IMSA, Institute of Math and Science Academy, that's outside of Chicago. Melissa Pollack, Senior Analyst at the National Science Foundation. Nick Allam, Lecturer at the University of Surrey in the U.K., and Sharon Friedman, Professor of Journalism and Communication at Lehigh University. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Sharon, is there a textbook example that we can watch now about how public policy or media coverage, actually media coverage, may be shaping our culture and public policy? We watch it happen?
Well, I think the newest textbook, there have been lots of them, but the newest textbook is probably nanotechnology. And many researchers are now getting in on the ground floor of trying to look at what is being communicated to the public via a number of different ways. I've been looking at media coverage of nanotechnology related to health and environmental risk, and watching it for, well, it's a period from 2000 to 2004, and trying to see how the reporters present the stories, whether they're overwhelmingly positive, whether they're negative in many ways, and looking from the risk perceptions, which would almost always be a negative presentation, I'm still finding a lot of positive information. So I would say, like many other new technologies, at the beginning of a new technology, we are being overwhelmed with very positive information about this technology. So far, so good.
Well, that didn't happen with genetically modified foods, did it, in other ways?
I think it did at the very beginning, but then there were some strange behaviors on the part of some of the companies, one in particular, that didn't do very well in communicating with citizens and the media, and that started to turn the tables.
It always happens when companies just don't react, you know, they give the impression they're hiding something.
Exactly. It was a question of trust, and that company lost trust almost immediately.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. If you want to ask a question in the audience, now's your time to come up and take hold of the mic, or just stand there at the mic stand. You don't have to hold on to the mic if you don't want to. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Gloria in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Gloria.
Hi.
Hi there.
Oh, I'm glad to be on your show and be able to ask you some questions. I have so many questions to ask you, so I have to limit my one to a real important. As being a science teacher, I'm saying, hey, look, how can we get the students more involved in science, taking a look at wanting to stay in science and go on? And I just see some of my students not wanting to go into science, not wanting to take the heavy science, not wanting to take the heavy math.
Math and Science Academy for students. How do you get kids to get interested?
Well, we look for kids who are interested in math and science. That's in this particular school, because the kids have all the goodies. They live in, they have the best teachers, they have free curriculum and so on. But we're also interested certainly in the issue of kids who are initially not interested in science. And schools, I think, play a crucial role in this. I think science ought to be taught as fun. It ought to be taught as important. It ought to be a motivating thing, because there are no longer jobs for of the menial kind. Robots and will do all the work. And so in order to get a good job, you have to be science literate. You have to know a little bit of algebra. You have to know how science works. So motivating kids, teaching them well, and continuously teaching them right through from preschool through 12th grade or 14th grade, kids are going to have to know science. This is a new world, the 21st century. And in that world, we've got to depend on the schools to raise the level of the general public.
Sharon, yeah.
Well, it's not just K through 12. It's universities as well. There is a drop-off in universities of students who want to take science, undergraduates and graduate students. And one of the ways you need to try and get around it is to make it interesting, and one of the better ways we're finding is to go to interdisciplinary kinds of programs and to offer not just the traditional sciences, but to merge the sciences and make it a bit more interesting for our students that way.
Hmm. Maybe it was from the National Science Foundation figures about the decline in the number of graduate students, right, who are getting science degrees. And there's just but at the same time, the jobs are on the rise. They're being unfilled.
Or they're being filled in other countries from students from other countries.
Yeah.
What I wanted to say, though, is it's not just what the schools are doing with kids. It's first of all, I think probably parents are the first influence in what kids decide to be, what professions they decide to pursue. But it's also looking at our culture and how heavily media influences decision making among kids. And I'll try and be quick about this, but when you look at what's on TV and you look out at how glamorous certain professions are, you know, you see doctors and you see lawyers and you see perhaps other professions, and they're portrayed with a lot of glamour and how exciting those are. And where are the scientists on TV?
Well, they're now all on CSI.
Right. Well, that's true.
But is that a positive?
That is
yes.
Yes, it is positive.
Can you see already something positive coming
Well,
out?
I think it's a little bit early for that, but I would hope that would be the case. Because as I said, that's what, you know, when it becomes fashionable to grow up to be a scientist, then maybe we will see more kids choosing science and engineering for careers.
Mm-hmm. Sharon, is that a good show for
Yes, I think it is, to some extent. What it does for role modeling, absolutely. And in fact, a number of technical programs and community colleges are reporting huge increases in enrollment in forensic studies. Mm-hmm. And everybody's getting very excited about that. What's bad about it is the compression, which is, of course, necessary for drama, in the amount of time that anything gets done. I mean, you know, they can just turn around a DNA test in 2 seconds. Of course, that really doesn't happen in a laboratory.
I have had I've had forensic specialists on who say, boy, I wish I had that little light they shine on that stuff. And suddenly, then,
you know, it's not only the what you teach in the way of science in the program. Look at Star Trek. Star Trek really doesn't teach any science, and yet it's enormously powerful. And we had a AAAS session on Star Trek once, crowded with people, like a holy roller meeting where scientists said, I watched it as a child, now I'm watching it with my children. It's the adventure and the glamour of advanced technologies.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Lawrence Krauss did a whole book called The Science of Star Trek, which got more people interested. Okay, let's see if we can go to the audience here and get this gentleman. Yes.
Yes, my name is William Waddell, and I teach at the Idlewild Arts Academy, which is a school for arts and academics.
And it's in New York City, right?
It's in Southern California.
Southern California is the other one in Idlewild. Well, I guessed wrong.
One of the things that I found with my students is that if I can get them to connect the science with what they're interested in, then that brings them closer to it and helps them to remember it. And I'm wondering if...
Can you give us an example?
Well, my students are in the arts. So, for example, I have students who study ceramics. And one of the ways that I teach chemistry when I talk about oxidation and reduction is to look at some of the work that's done in the kiln with glazes and to relate oxidation and reduction of the glazes and the patterns and colors that come out from that to the science. I'm wondering if anyone on the panel has any suggestions on methods of finding out what your students are interested in and relating the science to that so that they can remember it.
Hmm. Any suggestions? Leon?
Well, I think children are naturally curious, so I think it shouldn't be too difficult. There's a good concept which we work on which has to do with a concept called symmetry. Well, in art, symmetry is an important role. In architecture, in statuary, and so on, symmetry is crucial. It also turns out to be crucial in modern physics. You can't really do anything in modern physics without appreciating symmetry. And you can teach symmetry at the high school level because it is a phenomenon that you can demonstrate. You can talk about it. You can show different forms of symmetry and then open the suggestion that the symmetry really helps us understand how the world works.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Let's go to a little bit in detail about some of the studies about attitudes about science, and in particular one, Melissa Pollack, about evolution. You asked Americans about their views on evolution, and I think, if I read it correctly, you found a little trend changing in what they thought about evolution.
It turns out that the 2001 number we collected that showed actually an increase in belief in evolution in among the American public turns out it was probably a blip.
And because you've done further studies?
We have more recent data that hasn't been released yet. And it's that I'm telling you what's probably going to be the story, because the data have been consistent for so many years, and then all of a sudden in 2001 we saw an upturn. And I have thought about why that happened in that particular year. And the only thing I can think of is the tremendous amount of coverage that the situation in Kansas got in the media. And I think that just caused people to think about it. And it really did get...
The school board decision?
Exactly. Yeah. It was in all of the media, a lot of discussion, a lot of the talk shows focused on it. And I think people who were following that news coverage, it just caused them to think about it. Mm-hmm. And that probably is what is what you can attribute that blip to, because it's gone back down to what it was.
No kidding. Nick, but yet I was over in Europe a few weeks ago and I talked to people about evolution, and they don't know what I'm talking about. What kind of controversy? We accept this.
Yeah.
Is that a cultural thing, or what is that, do you think?
I suspect it's partially cultural. It's due to the different place of probably of religion you've got to remember that Europe is not just one, we've got different countries in Europe, obviously, and so it varies greatly from one place to the next. Mm-hmm. But certainly from my experience and my research in the UK, it's just not something that bothers people. It occasionally comes up, but I think it's more in reaction to hearing about press coverage from the US. So no, it's just one of those things which it's not a thing.
I would suggest that we have a whole bunch of new hospitals called creationist hospitals. If you are a creationist, go to this hospital, and we'll pray for you. And if you're worried about science, you go to this hospital, and we'll do surgery.
Okay. Yes, in the audience here.
Hi there. My name is Michael Halpern, and I'm from Washington, D.C. You talked a little bit earlier about the influence of politics in science. I know the Union of Concerned Scientists has a statement on scientific integrity that more than 6,000 scientists have signed on to at this point, alleging that the Bush administration has abused and manipulated science on issues as diverse as lead poisoning and childhood mercury. Is this a problem, and what kind of effect would this have on public trust in our esteemed government agencies?
Leanne, you want to take a
whack? I'm one of the signers of that, and I belong to the Union of Concerned Scientists, and I really believe it is a major problem. All governments have indicated biases when they apply science. That's not so unusual. What's unusual is about this particular government that has so blatantly ignored scientific advice to the peril. I mean, the biggest worry I have is global warming. And we're not in that. There's 130 countries that have signed on, overwhelming scientific evidence that human activity is affecting the climate of the planet, and with perils that are just unimaginably serious. And you just can't give advice to say, well, if you're worried about global warming, teach your grandchildren how to swim. That may be the only thing we can do if we keep ignoring, because we're the biggest polluter of all countries. And all these countries want to do something about reducing the greenhouse gases. And without our cooperation, nothing much is going to happen. So it is a very, very important issue.
We're talking about public understanding and attitudes of science this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's talk a bit about some other issues that will have, I'm sure, have differences, and maybe they're due to cultural changes or differences in countries. For example, what about nuclear energy, radiation, public attitudes? We're seeing really a renewed push toward nuclear power in China, in Europe, and whatever. We know that it's been stymied here ever since Three Mile Island. Sharon, are we going to be seeing shifts in attitudes, do you think?
Shifts in attitudes. Certainly,
The American attitude, will it come around to, is there no way to know that?
I'm not sure about the attitudes. We're certainly going to see a new group of nuclear power plants being proposed, and partially as an answer to global warming issues,
right,
which the industry has been trying to push for some time. Personally, I don't think we're going to get that very much online until we deal with the waste issue. Both the high-level waste and the low-level waste. And until we can get those things straightened out, I'm not sure that we'll be able to get, I don't think the companies will be able to get the secondary insurance that they need in order to be able to do that. As far as public attitudes are concerned, they're still pretty much very, against nuclear power for the most part, particularly in communities that live near nuclear power plants or storage areas.
Mm-hmm. Nick, this is... The Europeans are accepting the shift that...
No, I think in Europe as well, there's widespread opposition and a lack of optimism about nuclear power. Now, it does change the debate where you link it with global warming and more sustainable forms of energy. But it's interesting that nuclear power was the kind of archetypal new technology that people started being worried about. And, 30, 40 years on... attitudes remain pretty firmly set. There's not really any trend, and now this is in contrast to some other technologies where people get used to them and perhaps get a bit more relaxed about. So I think there's a big difficulty.
Well, I heard your own Prime Minister's science advisor, Dr. David King, at a conference saying that he thinks that the future is going to be fission for the next 30 years and then fusion if the warring countries can ever get together and to build one of these test reactors, where to build it.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's coming back on the political and scientific agenda, and I think that there'll be lots of people worrying about how to manage public opinion there. And I think, Sharon, you're right, the waste issue is absolutely crucial for public acceptance. And I think it's like all these things. If people see what are the clear benefits for your average person in the street, then the risks will be viewed in a different light, where people see the alternatives that they consider are superior to nuclear power, for instance, they won't change.
We're talking about the public attitudes in many parts of the world this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday. We're going to take a short break, come back, and hopefully we have a microphone standing here. You're more than welcome to get up and make a comment, a suggestion, a question. Maybe somebody, any of our school kids want to get up and say something? I'm trying to prod them like my own kids. Well, that doesn't seem to be working any better than with my own kids. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. We're talking this hour about public attitudes towards science with my guests, Sharon Friedman, Professor of Journalism and Communication, Director of the Science and Environmental Writing Program at Lehigh University, Nick Allam, Lecturer at the University of Surrey in the UK, Melissa Pollack, Senior Analyst at the National Science Foundation, and Leon Letterman, who is the founder of the Illinois Math and Science Academy. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. A question from the audience. Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm John Hildebrand. I'm the director of the Division of Neurobiology at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And I'm very involved with undergraduate as well as graduate education, particularly with general education in science. I happen right now to be involved with studies of science and general education, both in my university and through the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. I'd like to stimulate discussion on the panel and perhaps from the audience, about the proper place and nature of science in general education. This is a subject that is far from settled, and there's an ongoing debate about whether there should even be a privileged place for science in general education, and if so, what is its goal? Is it to turn people into scientists? Is it to, in other words, to recruit people to science? Is it to stimulate an understanding of the nature of the world and thereby dispel some misunderstandings and mystery? Or is it simply to enable an educated person to read the newspaper? I'd really like to know what the panelists think about that.
Okay. Let me start at this end. Leon, you want to?
I think that you can't have general education without science. It's meaningless. And I think all of your examples are valid. You might make a new scientist. I always believe there's no such thing as an average, because within an average group of people, there'll be one or two geniuses that somehow got missed. So I'm encouraged by that. But I think you almost skipped the most important reason is the general educated person is a voter, and a voter has to make his or her opinions known. He also is a family member and has to make decisions for the family. And so that requires some sense of how science works, some sense of what's nonsense in science, and what you want to believe in and what questions you want to ask. So these are extremely important issues that I think are crucial to when you say general education.
Melissa, any comments?
I second everything Leon just said. He took the mouth right out of my words.
All right, Nick, you're next.
I was just going to confirm what he said. We do want people when they read the newspapers to understand what they're reading, so that when they do go into the polling place, they are making wise decisions at the ballot box.
Right.
And we also want people to be able to make good decisions in their everyday life when it comes to all kinds of products and pitches that confront all of us as we go through our daily living.
You know, do you remember the Two Cultures, a book that was written in 1950?
C.P. Snow
in the 50s. And he talked exactly about this being the divide between the science people and the Sharon, you're nodding your head about this, about the science people and the intellectuals, so
right,
to speak.
I wanted to mention something, add something to what Leon said. I noted he said that he needed to know more, and in relation to science. I also want to say that she needs to know more, because women are the biggest consumers of medical and health information in the media and probably elsewhere, and they are primarily responsible for watching the health of their families, and trying to judge medical studies and science studies that relate to health is very, very important. And we find fewer women in taking science courses, and yet they really have probably one of the most important applications and needs in order to be able to understand these issues.
I was talking to here at the meeting about the loss of two great science writers on two big newspapers across the country who fired their science writers. And I was talking to a third one who said, you know, our newspaper, and it was a major newspaper, said, it's just hired a couple of science writers because they've decided that they want to do away with the science section but put more into the general section, in recognition that science has a bigger part. And we thought that was a great idea. Don't put it in its little ghetto, in its little box. Let's show that it's as important. What do you think about that, Sharon?
Well, that's been an argument from when they started science sections, and that is the science sections would highlight the material and give writers more space, which is a real problem in newspapers, or more airtime, which is even more of a problem on television and newscasts. And that was very attractive. But what it did do was build up a segregated area for science for many people, and only people who were highly interested in science would go to the science section. Luckily, there were still a number of stories that would come out that were based on events or studies that were coming out in the latest journal that would permeate and go through the entire newspaper. But for the most part, I think the readers of Science Times or some of the other science sections were people who were really interested in science, and you really didn't drag in the other folks.
So is this a good trend then, if they are actually hiring more science reporters and put them in the,
well,
scatter them around?
I'm glad to hear they're hiring some reporters.
Many more are fired, though.
Yes, and in the environmental journalism area, it's even worse.
CNN fired most of their science reporters.
Yeah, media consolidation and economic downturns gave the media a great opportunity to get rid of a lot of specialty staffs. And among the specialists that went were both science and environmental journalists. Of course, the sports writers didn't go, but the specialists in these other fields did, and that's creating a problem.
Yeah. There were on this paper that fired its sports reporter, there were 110 sports writers.
Right.
Go ahead.
I'd just like to note that also the astrology column is not gone, and that might be more beneficial. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the NSF especially documents the interest of science on the part of the general public. Tuesday's New York Times outsells all the other days of the week. Time magazine says if they put science on the cover, it sells out on the newsstands. Lots of other evidence that people are undernourished scientifically and want more information. The networks are outrageous, in my point of view, because, you know, legally they're supposed to do public service, but not at 2 a.m. on Sunday. I mean, you know, that's not fair. Mm-hmm. And I think they should spend more time on science and highlight some of the news in more time. I think it's terrible that in the 21st century, when science and technology are the driving forces for economic, social, cultural change, we spend so little of our effort teaching science to the general public.
Yes, let's go to the mic in the audience here. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Arna Cohen from Alexandria, Virginia. I'm one of the writers for the Science Friday Kids Connection, so it's my job to take the topics that you discuss on Fridays and make kids excited about them. Sometimes it's a challenge. I've written a lot of pieces about NASA and the future of NASA, and why does NASA exist, and all that. And I'm curious to know what the American public's view is as to whether NASA should continue to exist, if they're on the right track, if they should be doing something totally different, and what does the rest of the world think about NASA?
And the manned, so a person's space program versus the robotics, and now we're into a huge budgetary crunch over this. Go ahead.
Yeah, from the numbers I've looked at on public attitudes towards NASA, they're extremely favorable. And in particular, I looked at the numbers right after the most recent loss of the space shuttle, right. And even right after that happened, the public was still extremely supportive of NASA and what NASA did. However, when you look at surveys on what people are interested in, and there's a whole list of topics: science, inventions, the environment, schools, community news. Space ranks pretty much close to the bottom, and so you have sort of a mixed bag there in response to that question.
Mm-hmm. Leah?
Paradoxically, the scientific products of NASA are incredibly interesting. There's a seminar we're missing now on dark energy. That's probably one of the most dramatic changes in our view of how the world works, and mm-hmm. certainly will have an impact on the theory of relativity. Very deep, profound information is coming to us from the science part of NASA.
Mm-hmm. Nick, the European Space Agency just had this major triumph with the Cassini-Huygens mission and sending back those great pictures from Titan.
Now that there's been a fair amount of coverage of all of that, and I think space exploration, it's a kind of a sexy topic sometimes for the public. But I think that it's rated, if you ask people to rank kind of technologies and various types of activity. You find that space exploration is still, you know, people think that's a much better idea than nuclear power stations, for instance, in Europe right. still. So, but it's not, there are less kind of cultural attachments to that, I think, in uh-huh. Europe, and it's not a political issue.
Melissa, when you ask people questions about science, do you drill down to specific examples, or do you say, are you interested in space? I mean, you say space right down. But if you asked it, gee, would you like to have people on the moon or on Mars, or should we be sending robots, or would you like to have nice pictures coming back from the planets, would you get a different answer?
We have not asked those kinds of specific questions in recent years. We have asked them in past years. And basically, we do see a lot of public enthusiasm for NASA activities, for the Mars Explorer and for the other NASA projects. But it's not a question we've asked in real recent years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a question from the audience here. Yes.
Hi, my name is Gina Shaw. I'm a medical officer at the Centers for Disease Control, and I'm actually here for another conference that's occurring at this hotel at the same time as AAAS, which is the American College of Preventive Medicine. And a couple of the comments that were made regarding health and medicine sort of brought me to my current question and comment, and this is for the panelists in general. It seems that a lot of the glamorous part of medicine that the American public consumes highlights technology and high-tech procedures, and people may feel that these are unquestionably good. Some of the sessions that we've had have highlighted how some screening tests actually lead to a lot of false positives and lead to unnecessary pain and anxiety, but studies have shown that even those people who've actually undergone those tests and had a false positive still think, for the majority of them, still think that they're good. And so my question is, I think it's important to have people and women specifically to be more educated about science. But what about generally increasing people's ability to think critically about information rather than a kind of unquestionably accepting what's pushed out there in whatever format for their consumption?
Yeah, well, how do we get them to think critically? Lynn, any?
I think that's right. I think that it's a question of curricula. I do believe firmly that we're wasting enormous amount of time on kids in kindergarten through the beginnings of high school because we don't teach science well enough. Primary school teachers are untrained in math and science and therefore generate wrong attitudes on the part of young people. When you get to high school, we're doing one of my favorite subjects is teaching kids biology in ninth grade. That's crazy. Biology is a complicated, beautiful, and productive subject and should be taken after physics and chemistry so that kids know what a molecule is. So curriculum becomes very crucial in generating a way of thinking, and that's what you want for the average high school graduate and college graduate. You want a sense of just what you said, critical thinking, skepticism, curiosity, open-mindedness. All of these qualities that are wonderful in any profession should be part of the general public. And I think that's very important mission of science, media, museums, all the informal ways which we can reach people about science.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about science, teaching science, going the realm of science and culture. Melissa, you looked at people's belief in pseudoscience in your report. Does it affect their? Does the interest people may have as a curiosity about it? Does it affect their belief in pseudoscience or in science in general, or the validity of science?
Well, people can be supportive of science and think science is wonderful, and yet still maintain pseudoscientific beliefs. And in fact, the last question that we had here, I was going to respond and say, I don't know how to do it, because in talking sometimes to my friends and neighbors, you know, who subscribe to, for example, alternative therapies, you know, whether it be acupuncture, herbal remedies, magnetic therapies, I've had, you know, one-on-one conversations with my friends and neighbors and trying to, I guess, persuade them not to believe in those things. And I have met with zero success. and I don't know, you know, I don't know what I'm doing that's wrong, and I don't know that we can ever persuade people not to believe or to change their beliefs once these are really firmly held. I don't know what would do it.
Sharon?
I'd like the solution.
I think it's not as black and white as in all of these kinds of
pseudosciences. For example, I'm not sure I would call alternative medicine a pseudoscience. There are grants going out from the National Institutes of Health to fund research on pseudoscience. On alternative medicine. I don't think NIH would fund pseudoscience. But some of the issues that are being funded, such as acupressure, acupuncture, other things like that, you have to keep in mind that these have been part of traditional medicine in other countries for a long period of time. And we shouldn't overlook the traditions of other cultures. Maybe they're right about some of these things. And just because, I don't think we should draw a strict line.
And I would say because something has existed for thousands of years doesn't make it so. That's the problem. People say, it's been around for years, therefore it must be effective. Well, I actually think it's great what the NIH is doing now in funding research. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's been my understanding that so far nothing that has undergone that kind of scrutiny has proven effective.
I think chicken soup has been
okay. Yeah. Okay, yeah, sure. And that didn't cost us a lot of money to test.
I find it interesting that you haven't found a way of asking that question that separates whether the belief affects their belief in science, whether pseudoscience goes into science.
It's a
tough
good question. Research area.
Yeah. All right. We're gonna have to say goodbye because we've run out of time. I'd like to thank all of my guests, Leanne Lederman, Nobel Prize winner in physics, 1988. Founder of the Illinois Math and Science Academy, Melissa Pollack, Senior Analyst at the National Science Foundation, Nick Allam, Lecturer at the University of Surrey in the United Kingdom, Sharon Friedman, Professor of Journalism and Communication, and Director of the Science and Environmental Writing Program at Lehigh University. Thank you all for taking time and getting way out of that dark energy conference for us.